Welcome to the Brave Little Podcast. Coming from California, here's Aaron Alvarado and David Stauffer.
Welcome to the Brave Little Podcast. It's my favorite pod of the year. Top 10 films of 2018. Such a special pod. And we are joined, as always, by Aaron Alvarado in Los Angeles. Aaron?
I'm feeling pretty special. Thanks for having me on.
And back with us, a returning guest that has appeared on more podcasts this year than our third host, Skylar. It's Shannon Williams in Orem, Utah. Shannon.
Hello. Hey, thanks for having me back.
Welcome.
We're thrilled to have you. I'm legitimately excited to hear what both of you have in your top 10. I mentioned in the pre-pod, this is always the longest pod of the year. May or may not break it up into two. I'm going to do my best to quarterback this and try to get it moving as fast as possible, which is a tricky role to have considering I'm the person that also probably doesn't know when to stop talking and will over-talk. Definitely shouldn't be holding that job, but here I go.
Also, you were a terrible quarterback.
Oh, yes. No, absolutely. No. But yeah, I mean, I played quarterback in high school. So in high school football.
Did you really?
Yeah, yeah, because they can't cut you, right? And I refused to play. I was like, I'll be the fifth string, sixth string, doesn't matter, but I'm a quarterback. Like, I played no other position. Like, you literally can't throw the ball. Like, you're not good at this at all. And I was like, all right, they just bench me. Just because I wanted to tell people, like, yeah, I played quarterback in high school.
QB5 was your nickname.
QB5. I will say I'm definitely better than Matt Saracen. I just didn't get the opportunity he got because the guys above me didn't get paralyzed. So, none of that is true. But all right, well, let's get into this. There are a couple things I want to talk about other than the fact that the last time I looked, the Kings are beating the Lakers right now. And so are you watching the game right now?
I'm not watching, no.
Okay.
I'm boycotting.
Boycotting because the last game, which was literally the last game both our teams played, we the Kings won at the buzzer.
Exactly. Had no business winning that game. It was a terrible call. Should have never happened. Mm. And I'm now protesting the rest of the season. So
I see. Well, imagine how I felt after 2002. I have been protesting for well over a decade. all right. Well, that's the last time I'm going to bring that up because LeBron James isn't playing for the Lakers, so it's not exactly a time for me to talk trash about my team beating your LeBron-less team. We have top 10 to go through. I do want to talk about first the bubble films, the ones that were just outside the top 10 that we couldn't sneak in. I just want to know what was on the bubble for both of you. In addition to that, I want to know either you can choose to give me one or both, your least favorite film or the worst film you saw in 2018, as well as the most disappointing film. Okay. And and I think that's it. And then we'll get into our top 10. Shannon, want to kick us off with your bubble films?
Yeah. There were so many. So I don't want to say. I had my top nine like locked down, okay. But it was really coming up with the 10th that there were so many that could have been in there. I really liked A Star Is Born and that didn't make it in. Annihilation, Free Solo, the documentary. What else? Widows.
Oh, yeah.
I think those are probably the biggest ones.
All right.
There were a lot. It was a good year for movies, apparently, because I could have gone with like a top 30. So.
Did it feel like a good year for movies? Like as we were going along throughout the year, did it feel like this is a strong year to you?
Well, okay. So here's the thing. Last year, like my top three, so Lady Bird, Call Me By Your Name, and Blade Runner 2049 were both, nothing this year was as good as those three to me. So this year I was even struggling to figure out what was my number one, because I was having a hard time figuring out, like, was there one movie I was super passionate about? So I don't think there was anything that I was like, oh my gosh, everyone should see this. This is amazing. But like, there was a lot of really good, solid stuff, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. That's the exact same way that I felt. So,
yeah.
Well, what's interesting about that is last year, 2017 closed really strong. Like Lady Bird. You talk about Lady Bird and Blade Runner and Call Me By. Those were all released towards the end of the year. I think, especially for Call Me By Your Name and Lady Bird. I'm trying to remember. Blade Runner was still in Q4.
I thought that was summer.
Was it summer?
I can't remember.
It's definitely in the second half, we'll say. But like the Oscar fairs, you know, the movies that come out and the Oscar season, whatever. Like usually you can count on three or four like really good ones that are going to, you know, for me, going to make my list. That was not the case this year. Yeah. It did not end strong.
Yeah.
This is the most surprising top 10 list I've ever written. Surprising for a lot of reasons. Surprising the way I was introduced to some of these films, the way I came across some of these, my reaction to some of these. My number one film completely shocks me. Now, don't get me wrong, I am passionate about it, and it absolutely belongs as my number one, but I would have never imagined that this would be my favorite film of the year. And so it feels kind of weird because I do love some of the gems, but overall, it pales in comparison to last year. It just does.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're totally going to get agree. This. And I know, Shannon, you're really into the Oscars. And I am.
It's going to be a rough year.
It's going to be rough.
I don't know what's going to win.
Well, we don't even know who's hosting. I'm like, it's a mess. Yes. Everything's a mess. Though I will say, though,
it's all falling apart.
It's going to be better having not been hosted by Kevin Hart. And that has nothing to do with what he's tweeted. It has everything to do with him not being funny.
I mean, we got Kevin Hart canceled, but I'm sorry. Can we get the Oscars canceled?
Yeah. Well, if the Oscars so white controversy is not going to cancel it, nothing will. If getting Best Picture
for my sake, incorrect, no.
If the envelope switcheroo doesn't get it canceled, I mean, they've got one job to do. The only thing people are paying attention to is they just want to know what the best movie is. They didn't even get that right two years ago. You know, like, yeah. Yeah. Should be canceled.
Yeah, they're failing horribly at it. But
so, Aaron, what
I'll still watch it.
I want to know what your bubble films are.
My bubble films. I actually, I was looking at my list, and basically, my favorite films ended up in the top 10 or so. I think maybe there was one or two. I'm trying to think of what my final list looked like that didn't make it in there. But overall, I think, for the most part, everything that I really, really enjoyed made it in. I think a movie like Game Night is something that, like, it doesn't belong in a top 10, but I really enjoyed it. So it's more movies that are like that. Some of the documentaries, like the Three Strangers, I think it's called. This is really good.
Strangers.
Yeah, Three Identical Strangers, really good movie, but didn't end up in my top 10. Movie like We Are Animals was really interesting, really good art house movie. Didn't end up in my top 10. But there's a lot of those kind of like the second level movies that I thoroughly enjoyed, but I just didn't think they were strong enough to be what I would consider a top 10. So,
yeah, that you bring up a good point. This is where I struggle with my top 10 because I want to use it as a recommendation list, right? Like, and it certainly serves as that because it says these are the movies I loved, but it doesn't necessarily say these are the movies that are the most underappreciated or criminally underseen, right? And so a movie like Death of Stalin, which was on my bubble, is one that like I appreciate so much for what it did. It tried to do a very difficult thing with its subject matter, as well as the tone, as well as the humor and how like just razor sharp that film. It's really something incredible, but just not quite in my top 10. I just didn't enjoy it as much as the movies that are in my top 10, but I want people to experience it because it's a really unique accomplishment. I gotta say, I was introduced to that film because a former coworker of mine, my last job, who grew up in Russia, basically told me not to see this movie because it was too soon to be doing any satire on Stalin, and that was nothing gets me to the movie theater faster than someone saying this is too soon to this humor is like too soon humor. I'm like, oh yeah, okay, and I'm like, where's the closest theater? No disrespect to that person, but I don't have family stories of the horrors of Stalin's rule, so I'm able to be pretty far removed from that. But it's a movie that does something that's I think biting and funny and great, and I wish I could have made it. Mission Impossible Fallout is just outside my top 10. I love this movie. It's such a it's a great action film, but it's also as good as Ghost Protocol and in Rogue Nation. And which are great films, but just didn't make my top 10. And admittedly, I pulled it out of my top 10 because I Skylar was going to be joining us today before he realized it was his anniversary. So I knew he was going to be talking about it, and that's why I pulled it out. So, and then lastly, Annihilation, another one that I knew Skylar was going to talk about, so I pulled out. So I'm really got a couple L's there. Annihilation, similar to Death Stalin, though, is like a type of film that I think is an incredible feat and needs to be seen. So those are my bubble films. So quickly, worst or most disappointing? Shannon, let's do this.
I feel like franchise movies just kind of bummed me out all year long. last time I was on, we talked about Crimes of Grindelwald. I'm a big Harry Potter fan, so that was super disappointing. Solo, I thought, was really disappointing. Yeah. I was just talking on my own podcast about this, and I said I was out from the time they said how he got his name. I'm done. It's so stupid. It was rough.
Oh my gosh.
And the end of Infinity War, I wasn't that happy with either. So it's like every major franchise I follow this year, I was just like, you kind of failed me on every level.
Are you unhappy because it treats the audience like they're idiots, or unhappy because it's like,
yes.
Okay, yeah, that's right. That's the right take to have.
It's because the thing I don't like about Marvel films is that they'll like fake kill someone off and then bring them back. They do it with Loki. They've done it with so many people, and this whole movie was just that. Yeah. Like fake killing everyone off.
Along with your theme of the disappointment in franchise fare, throw in Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom.
Oh gosh, I mean, yeah.
Talk about disappointing. I mean, yeah, how can you screw up dinosaurs? They managed to do it. And then Ocean's 8, okay? Like, literally the formula is grab a bunch of the biggest stars, okay, and like throw them in a movie and have fun, get loose, and they got great cast. What a disappointment that movie was given what it could have been. Ugh. Aaron, how about your were you disappointed by any movies this year?
Oh yeah, I mean, basically every movie disappointed me in some way. Most of them were just not long enough. I love a long movie. Well, number one, like we just talked about the other day, it was Vice. That's the one movie I was looking forward to. Probably the one movie that I was looking forward to more than anything in this end of the year. And I just didn't like it at all. So that was probably my number one. But number two...
Criminal misuse of Jesse Plemons. Sorry.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. No one knows how to use Jesse Plemons.
Can I...
Yeah.
Can I just say, I was afraid to listen to your podcast about Vice because I didn't like it and I thought you two were going to like it.
No.
And I'm like, I can't hear this.
It's bad.
So that makes me happy that you weren't thrilled about it.
I liked it a little more than Aaron, but I definitely, that movie does not work.
I'll just say.
It has its moments, but. Ooh,
exactly. Yeah. I had more fun.
That was a mess.
During the actual presidency of George W. Bush and Cheney than in the movie. Yeah. So,
to be honest, I would have had more fun had I like literally walked out when the first credits roll about 45 minutes in, that little, which I actually, I thought that was a pretty funny bit. They rolled the credits when it, you know,
yeah,
I was like, oh
was
yeah,
clever.
Okay.
Vice was my number one. My number two was actually The Predator. I'm a huge Predator fan, Shane Black fan, and the movie just wasn't good. So. Mm. I was let down in a big way.
Bummer.
Yeah, I still thought Predator was it was such a mess, but kind of a fun mess where you're like, man, you guys screwed this up. This is so nonsensical.
They blew it.
Ridiculous. Yeah. And like, this should be easy, but I still had fun watching it, but it's such a bad movie.
It's not
just
good.
Like,
yeah.
I mean, it's like, yeah, it doesn't make sense. It's terribly put together.
I saw one last night. Now that you say like nonsensical mess that's still fun to watch. Have you heard of Anna and the Apocalypse?
Oh, yeah.
Have either
of
you seen this? So it's like a zombie apocalypse musical. Oh, so combining my two favorite things in the world. But it is such a disaster. But I sat there laughing and my brother was like, how do you not hate this? Yeah. And I'm like, it's just a riot with how bad the writing is in that movie.
Totally.
So.
That's all right. Shall we get into our top 10 films of the year?
Let's do it.
Okay.
Let's do it.
Before you say your 10, maybe just say a little bit about your methodology in selecting these films. And if there were any themes or things you noticed or anything interesting at all about the list, give us a little preamble and then your number 10. So we'll start. We'll go Shannon, Aaron, and then I'll go.
Okay. Yeah, this is really hard. I guess I was trying to make sure I got kind of a mix of stuff. So, like we were talking before, I wanted to make sure I got at least one female director in there, like a little bit more representation. I feel like I still failed at that. But and then genre-wise, I was thinking, oh, like I have one animated film, one, I don't know. I was trying to like get a mix of stuff, I guess. And a couple of things that I didn't think people would have seen that I really liked that I want people to see. So, which I guess leads into my number 10 that I ended up going with. So number 10 is Burning, which is a Korean film. Have either of you seen it?
No, I want, it's on my list to watch, but no, I haven't seen it.
Oh, good. It's really interesting. and I feel like it's a movie I can't say a whole lot about without giving it away. But it's about, and I'm going to, I mean, it's in Korean, so I'm going to slaughter isn't it, everyone's isn't it about names
Bradley
in it.
Cooper as a chef?
yes. no.
Oh, that's burnt.
Oh, gosh.
Sorry.
Yeah. That's yes. Oh, gosh, no. Yeah, so it's about this kid, Yong-soo. Again, I'm sorry about the names. But so this kid in Korea who kind of runs into a girl that he used to know. They're from the same neighborhood. And he kind of becomes infatuated with her really quickly. And she invites him. She's taking this big trip. And so she says, oh, you need to look after my cat. And he's kind of, I don't know, longing for her to come back. Like, it's really infatuated right away. And she comes back with this guy, Ben, who's played by Steven Yeun, which is one of the best performances of the year, I think. He's so excellent. I loved him in Walking Dead. Yes. And so I'm really glad that, and I loved him this year too in Sorry to Bother You, which is like 2/3 of a really great movie for me. Mm. But yeah, so he's had a good year. Anyway, so he comes back with her, and it creates this sort of awkward like love triangle between the three, but he's kind of sketchy, and I don't think I can say any more about it without giving too much away, but it's this like very slow burn thriller. Feels really natural though, like it's not the music, it's not played up to, I don't know, really get you looking for a twist. It just plays out as it would play out in real life, and yeah, the ending really surprised me.
is there a movie you would most compare it to, or like if you'd say if you like this movie, Burning's gonna be right up your alley? Like, what's a reference point?
Oh gosh, I'm not sure. That's the thing, is I don't feel like I've seen a lot of, can you think of, like, slow thrillers. Yeah. It's 2.5 hours long. Ooh. It takes a lot, like you really have to be patient. So I guess that's my, if you're willing to,
if you're
really, like,
yeah, if you're super
hold
patient
out.
Person and you watch The Walking Dead.
Yes.
You know, I've been hearing great things about Burning, and it's on my list of films I really wish I could have gotten around to before making this list. I'm really glad to see it on yours.
Yeah. So great performances in it. Yeah. I don't want to say too much. Right. Just see it.
Burning.
I don't want to ruin it.
All right, Aaron.
Sounds good. So how I came about my list, every year I usually, I have like basically two criteria. One is like the entertainment factor. Give me a good entertaining movie and I'll throw it on my top movies of the year. Two is the effect that the movie has on me after the fact. So if I watch your movie and I'm thinking about it for days after, then I know it's a really great movie. So that's basically what my two movies are. That's basically the one and two categories that I base all my list on. So, and I wasn't particularly concerned about genre or anything like that. And I actually think representation doesn't matter. So I'm just kidding. Totally kidding. Totally kidding.
The one non-white person on the pod right now. Is
I'm allowed to say that stuff. So my number 10 is a movie. It's a comedy. It's probably my first or second favorite comedy that I've seen this year. Top one or two. It's a movie called Flower. I don't know if you guys saw this one.
I didn't.
It's starring Tim Heidecker, Catherine Hahn, and Zoe Deutsch. Is that how you say her name? Zoe.
I thought it was pronounced Kazan.
Yeah.
But okay.
Yeah. Different Zoe. Zoe Deutsch. Yes. Zoe Deutsch plays this this really dysfunctional teenage girl who finds out she has a stepbrother who just got out of rehab, and she decides to get him out of his funk that he's in. He's literally suicidal, and he's like just coming off a drug addiction, and she decides to flip his life upside down and take him on this adventure involving a lot of mischief. I'll just put it that way. They run into Adam Scott, who is who may or may not have performed some inappropriate acts on the stepbrother when he was younger. And that's kind of like the mystery angle of the movie, but it's actually really funny. The movie's lighthearted.
It's Catherine Hahn and Adam Scott.
Catherine Hahn, Adam Scott, Tim Heidecker.
Reunited.
Exactly. Wow. This is they've teamed up. Actually, I don't think they act in any scenes together in this movie, but they're in the same movie. The movie's just really funny. It's only 90 minutes long, which is the perfect length for a comedy for me, and it held my attention throughout. And I just felt it was like just really funny. It's not a great movie, but highly enjoyable. So the movie is called Flower. Yeah.
Awesome.
All right. Hard R, by the way. That is, it's rated R, and with good reason.
That's why this pod is sponsored by the folks at VidAngel. See Flower without the guilt.
Oh, gosh.
All right. So
don't get me started on VidAngel.
My top 10. Aaron, I liked your point about a movie affecting you after the fact. It made me think of actually my number 4 film, which of course we'll eventually get to, is a film that especially did that. I've thought more about that specific film than any, and I hate to be a tease, but you'll find out soon enough. But it's fascinating when a movie, no matter how you react to it initially, if it can stay with you day after day, actually it increases the overall experience with that film, because it kind of that thinking about it after the fact is still part of that experience, viewing and dissecting and, you know, internalizing a movie. And I think one of these movies that I say, number 4 on my list, it's probably wouldn't have been, I mean, it would have been a lot lower on the list had it not had that effect. Enjoyment is a huge deal to me. I mean, just something I had fun with, something that, I just walked out and just had an experience that I felt like only that movie could have given me. So I guess enjoyment as well as uniqueness, something that was not just a bold or ambitious effort to be unique, but like something that does it successfully and effectively, right? There's a lot of indie films. I think they've started to get a little bit better, but for a while their indie films would just try and be quirky and would have a 10-second animation sequence out of nowhere. You know, there's like all these things you'd throw in, right? Like that... would almost be pseudo good art, and so something that truly is bold but effectively so. So anyway, that's some of my criteria. But my number 10 film is a film. It's actually one of two films of the year that has a 100% rating on Rotten Tomatoes with over 200 reviews logged, and that film is Leave No Trace by Deborah Granik. Can either of you name what the second film was that also accomplished that?
No.
Is it Paddington 2?
It is.
Yes.
It's Paddington 2. Speaking of bubble films, I honestly, for about maybe 10 months out of this year, this past year, I was certain Paddington would not only be in my top 10, it'd be in the top 5. It's so excellent. And so to see it.
It's really great.
Yeah, oh, it breaks my heart. So it's at my 14, I think, which is, you know, a huge disrespect to an otherwise just lovably affable bear. But anyway, yeah, Paddington 2, 100% with over 200 reviews and Leave No Trace. So either of you see this movie?
Yes.
I haven't seen it.
I loved it.
So this is this movie, it was incredible. It's a film with Ben Foster and a newcomer who I think is absolutely incredible, Thomasin McKenzie. She's an actress from New Zealand. She's just a teenager. But this is a story about a recent war vet that's suffering from PTSD. That's Ben Foster's character, who is trying to survive out in the wild wilderness outside of Portland with his teenage daughter, with, you know, essentially homeless, having a forest encampment and evading any authorities. And it takes what would otherwise be really heavy and, you know, in some cases dark subject matter, And Deborah Granik just has this gentle touch with it in a way that makes it way easier to consume, and not only consume, but also relate and feel for these characters as both the father character and the daughter character. While there's such clear and obvious love between them two, are on completely different paths. And it's a film that was equal parts hopeful and heartbreaking. And I just was stunned by it when I watched it, because I mean, I didn't know a whole lot about it other than I think I watched maybe half of a trailer. This is another one where I just feel like not a lot of people saw this movie, but it's hard to sell them on, like, you got to get to the Megaplex to see this soldier who has PTSD try to survive in the wilderness with his, you know what I mean? It doesn't really lend itself to the elevator pitch. But I really think this was masterful tone work by Deborah Granik and Thomasin McKenzie. I think she should absolutely be nominated for, I don't know if it'd be supporting actress or actress. I mean, she's the main actress in this. So I mean, that would be a lead role.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, so I'd be thrilled to see her win. She won't, unfortunately, because other people that are nominated have multiple Grammys and millions of dollars. And
now, can you compare this movie to Captain Fantastic in any way? Because
no, it's interesting that you say that. Similar? I have not seen Captain Fantastic.
Oh,
come on, man!
I won't see Viggo.
It's so good. Really good.
I just can't see Viggo Mortensen movies after his just the foul language that he has.
Good point.
You know, I'm kidding. I'm referencing the scandal where he used the N-word in the promotion tour for Green Book. I mean, he used it in trying to make a bigger point about the events that are taking place historically in Green Book. He didn't use it as like necessarily in a diatribe. Not defending him. I don't think she should have said it, but he didn't say it like in a Mel Gibson drunken stupor type of way.
Yeah, it wasn't flipping. He was
flipping at all.
He was trying to give some social commentary, and may have missed.
He inadvertently became the Captain Fantastic for the alt-right. So there you go.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I don't know if I can relate the movie to it. Although judging by the trailer, it seems like kind of a similar type of film.
Yeah.
But anyway.
In subject matter, sort of, but like the tone of those two movies, I think, are very different.
Oh, cool. Okay.
I agree with you, though, Stauffer, that I just wanted to add that the way that she treats Deborah Granik, that you don't, the dad, like, his actions are really hurting his daughter, but you sympathize with both of them. Like, you feel for both of them. And I think it would have been so easy for her to say, like, to villainize the father, and she doesn't. So
and that's what makes it so heartbreaking is because really well you can tell he truly loves her, and also that he's incapable of providing her with the basic needs for her growth and development. And she has to realize that and make an important choice in the movie. And it's heartbreaking to see, but it's devastatingly authentic. And, it's just a great movie.
Is that out on video? Can I like rent that or something?
You know,
where can I see it?
I wish I would have looked that up for all 10 of mine so I could tell people where to go.
It came out a while ago, indeed. So you would think.
I think it was. I think it was like made for $3.5 million and made $3.4 or something.
Ooh,
like that.
So, boy.
Yeah. Everyone watch.
Well, again, it's not. I don't know. Yeah, movies like this are hard to greenlight. I mean. I'm grateful Deborah was able to do it. Obviously a small budget, but it needs to be seen by more people. So, all right, number nines.
Awesome. Yeah. So mine is The Favorite.
Oh.
Directed by Yorgos Lanthimos.
Yes.
Another
one I did not see and wanted to, so I'm excited.
Really? Okay, well, good. Honestly, this one would have been higher up on my list if parts of it didn't make me so dang uncomfortable, which is intentional because it's Yorgos Lanthimos. Mm-hmm. So this film is about, Queen Anne, it's a period piece. So you have Queen Anne, and who's played by Olivia Colman, who at this point should probably win the Oscar. I think we just give it to her. But anyway, all three performances in this are so good. You have Rachel Weisz, who's her kind of like right-hand woman. And then you have Emma Stone, who plays Abigail, who comes in. And she was a lady and has fallen from grace. And so all of these women kind of have motives to try. At least Sarah and Abigail have motives to try to get the queen on their side. So it's just these three women being really catty toward each other.
Say no
I don't
more.
It's just the funniest thing.
Much yeah, like real life when you get three women together.
Oh my gosh.
Sorry, Shannon.
Oh gosh.
I had to.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just, it's set, you know, back in, I don't know, the 1800s or whatnot, but nothing about the tone of this film or the actions of it, it feels very modern and weird otherwise. I just really like, Joe Alwyn is in it as, like Emma Stone's kind of guy in it. And there's a part where they're all dancing and they just start like break dancing, which isn't something that would have happened in this period. So there's just like really weird moments like that. Just the more I think about the film though, the more I like what it says about power and, I don't know, again, like so much of what I like is the end and I don't want to spoil it, but yeah, very funny and weird. And I think Lanthimos like just really takes chances and I appreciate him for it.
I'm a huge Yorgos fan, which is why it's embarrassing that I haven't seen it yet. I also haven't seen Killing of a Sacred Deer, and I might take back that I'm a huge Yorgos fan because maybe it's just because I love the
that
lobster.
I didn't like that one.
You're just a lobster fan. That's all
I just
you
realized.
Are.
Like, oh, I just like one of them.
the lobster is great.
Oh, yeah, but similarly, so, I mean, unsettling and you know hard to watch. I people who have seen it have only said great things. People talk about it being hilarious. I'm excited to see it. I'm grateful I made one of our top tens.
It's so funny.
Did you see Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette, Shannon?
Yes.
Okay. So
for the first time.
Oh,
this
really?
Year,
so
think.
Like one of the big criticisms of that movie is that the soundtrack specifically uses modern music in it, and some people had a problem with that because it's you know set in an old time. And would you compare the two at all? Do you think there's any similarity between that and The Favourite?
No. it uses all classical pieces as far as music goes.
But I think
I don't know.
I think one of the,
I guess what I'm
the, one of the main criticisms was that when people were listening to this modern music in Marie Antoinette, they were getting pulled out of the story because it's just so like it's so like jolting basically. When you bring up The Favourite, A Knight's Tale, there you go.
I mean it has Queen We Will Rock You and that was fine. For the matches didn't take me out at all.
Yeah.
I guess what I mean, because aside from the breakdancing part, there's not a whole lot of stuff that's like, it doesn't belong in this period. What I mean is when you see period pieces, I normally think of, like Jane Austen ones where everyone is very like polite toward each other and it just does not fit that mold. People say things that you wouldn't think they would be saying and act in ways you wouldn't think they'd be acting in, especially in a court.
See, that sounds really appealing to me because I don't don't care for the old stuffy period pieces. So I'm in on The Favourite eventually.
There's this part between Emma Stone and Joel Alwyn, the whole time she's kind of trying to, he's at a higher status than she is. So she's kind of thinking, well, if I can see he's interested in me. So if I get him on my side, then maybe I can, you know, be with him and become a lady again. Anyway, there's this whole part between them in the woods where they're just kind of like, he's trying to kiss her, but then she like punches him and then they're like rolling in the woods. And it was just so funny that I can't get it out of my head. And especially because he's dating Taylor Swift and I just can't imagine like what Taylor Swift thinks of this film. Anyway.
Would it be appropriate to put dating in quotes?
Yeah, probably.
I'm kidding. All right, Aaron.
But yeah.
What's
one time.
So we're at number 9, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so number 9 for me is You Were Never Really Here.
Ooh.
Directed by Lynn Ramsey.
Great.
Yes, starring Joaquin Phoenix. This is maybe the darkest movie on my list. It's pretty dark. I don't know if you guys have seen this one yet.
Incredible closing shot, though.
Oh, yeah. There's so many things about this movie. I love the atmosphere of it. I love the weight of the characters. I love Joaquin Phoenix's performance. For anyone that doesn't know, just a quick synopsis. It's the story is a traumatized veteran tracks down missing girls for a living, and one of his jobs kind of spirals out of control. He stumbles upon a conspiracy with someone in the government. I can't remember, like a senator or something. Yeah. And it's basically like Taken, kind of. Like, a lot of people compare it to the movie Taken, but it's way, way, way darker, much darker, way heavier. Joaquin barely speaks in this movie, but he is so brooding and scary that he really carries it. So I really enjoyed You Were Never Really Here. So it's on my list.
There's such authenticity in that performance that it really makes me feel like Joaquin would be capable of doing that job in real life. Like, he's like broken enough of a human in real life that it's like that he could not only do that job, but he would also do it in a similarly broken manner like that. I'm like,
yeah, that's the thing. So he's playing that broken man again, PTSD, ex-vet type of thing.
He does better than anyone. I mean,
oh yeah,
the master. He plays that broken man, also a vet. But not saving people in that one.
No, a veterinarian.
All right. Wow. I didn't think that was going to be your top 10. That's exciting. That's
good. It's a great one.
And that movie's really dark, but doesn't get very graphic with the violence, which I really appreciated.
Yeah, it's more the...
And it was so short and tight.
Exactly. Oh,
like, she very concise.
And I love the music in it, too. They use this this song... Angel Baby is the song, and it's like reoccurring throughout the movie, and I just love the emotions that evokes when she chooses to use it. It's really cool.
All right, my number 9 is a documentary. It is Three Identical Strangers. This is a film that I actually took my parents to, and for some reason I felt like they would like it. I mean, not like my parents are huge documentary people, but I took them over.
They're big fans of triplets.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, huge. They love anything that comes in threes. They're in. But it just felt it's like a interesting, fun story. And what that story is it's about triplets that were separated at birth and adopted into three different families. What's crazy about that is the families who adopted these three kids didn't know that they were one of three. So the families themselves, the parents who adopted it, didn't know that they were adopting a triplet. And so what gets interesting is when it gets to the college years and one of them essentially runs into another at this college, I believe in upstate New York. And then things, this is all in the very beginning of the film, so no real spoilers here. It's also, obviously a real story. But it basically makes news headlines that these long-lost twins were reunited, and then the third of the triplets sees it in the paper, and he's like, what? Like, those two guys look like me. And so that's the initial premise of the movie is about this crazy occurrence. But that's just the surface-level stuff. What I didn't realize when watching it is that this movie dives into something much deeper than how mind-blowing it is that triplets were separated at birth. It dives into the question of, why were they separated and why didn't the parents know? And it takes you on this journey, this path that was unexpected and really thought-provoking and heartbreaking and surprising and maddening and in some ways joyful. It's just the characters themselves, the actual triplets, it's helpful that they're charismatic AF, pardon my French, but they really are they just seem like likable, fun people to be, especially the footage from, when they were younger. And it's just one of those stories that is tailor-made for a documentary. I loved it. My parents loved it. It was a great experience watching it with them. And again, just really thought-provoking. So I don't know where it's accessible right now in terms of Hulu or Netflix. Hopefully it drops on Netflix soon since it seems like everyone has that. But yeah, that's my number 9, Three Identical Strangers.
That was when I saw it at Sundance because I kept hearing how good it was. And I said, okay, I need to make time for that. Oh, it's super good. Yeah.
All right. Number 8?
Yeah, so my number 8, we got another documentary. Minding the Gap is what it is. And this one's on Hulu. So I don't know if it ever actually came to theaters or if it's just been streaming, but you can watch it now. I actually watched it this weekend and was affected enough by it.
Quick note, sorry.
Yeah.
The question of whether it was released in theaters is a good one. I do know that it is on the short list for Oscar consideration for documentaries. Now, doesn't that require a theatrical release? I wonder if it was just like released in Chicago for a day or something. But you're the Oscar head, so I guess I look to you for authority. Does it have to have a theatrical release in order to be considered?
Yes, okay. It does, but it doesn't have to be long. So I think it only needs to run for like a week or something, and they can do it in like New York, LA, big cities. Yeah. So Netflix has been doing that with a lot of its films. Like for Roma, it's been running it in more and more theaters, but for a lot of theirs, they just do it for, you know, a couple of weeks and then call it good just so they get in contention. So
great.
Yeah.
So it's on Hulu, so it's accessible.
Yeah, so watch it. So it's a documentary. It's done by Bing Liu, who he's actually a subject in the film. So it's these three young men who are from Rockfield, Illinois. They so it's about they all skateboard is kind of their link to each other and how they all met. And I saw mid-90s this year and liked it, but was not. People were kind of pushing that one like, oh, it's Jonah Hill's Lady Bird. And I that one wasn't as emotionally resonant to me. But if you liked mid-90s or even if you liked kind of the premise of that but wanted it to go deeper, I think this is that film. Like, this is what I wanted mid-90s to actually be. So the three of them, the reason Bing Liu did this film, so all of them have had encounters, I guess, with their dads. They were victims of domestic violence at one point, to different degrees, but so Bing Liu made this film realizing that his two friends have also experienced that, have fathers who beat them or discipline them, like, to different degrees. And so he's trying to work through what happened to him and just the way the three of them, how their lives turned out so differently from how they've reacted to them growing up in these households is really interesting. So yeah, it was so personal. The shots too of the skateboarding are really incredible. Because the director, you know, skateboards himself, he, I think, is often just holding the camera and following them as they skateboard. So the shots in it are really incredible. I was just really moved by it. Oh, yep.
I'll be adding a little bit more on Minding the Gap in there.
Spoiler.
Okay.
But I'll just say Zach is a piece of trash. But that's
good. Yes. I wasn't going to get into that.
But grateful that he allowed himself to be portrayed candidly and authentically, even if...
Yeah, well, is that something... It's a split, but so one of them ends up abusing his girlfriend, and so it's this cycle of how this keeps continuing through these families, and it's fascinating.
Gosh, that's...
And sad. That's but really yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Aaron, did you catch Minding the Gap?
No, I haven't. It's on my list now because you guys are talking it up. So yeah. I also
so good.
Kind of lukewarmly enjoyed mid-90s. So this one sounds really interesting.
So, I mean, I alluded to Minding the Gap being, you know, it's a couple picks up for me. But so we'll get to it. I liked mid-90s enough that at one point in my top 10 list, it was my number 10 because there was enough about it that I liked that I wanted to talk about, even with the problems I have with the movie. And then I saw Minding the Gap literally earlier this week, and to Shannon's point, it's absolutely the movie that Jonah Hill wishes his could have been.
So it kick-flipped over. Yeah.
At 50
over mid-90s.
This is a shove it, is what this is.
It's 720 to round mid-90s.
All right, Aaron, you're number eight.
My number eight is a movie we talked about a lot, the movie Green Book with Viggo and Mahershala Ali. Number eight.
Green Book's in my top 15, so just outside.
Very good, very good. Yeah, I just had too much fun at that movie, and
true, and because it's probably all false.
Yeah, I mean, I expect that. I expect that at this point. So it was it was too much family fun for me to leave it off my top 10 list. Yeah. So
there has been some controversy about the authenticity of that relationship. Sure. It was really like that, and honestly, this is a film best consumed if you assume that it's all fiction.
That's the thing. I wanted zero additional information after seeing that movie, just because I knew it was going to break the bubble. Absolutely. And it was going to disappoint me, whatever I found
Absolutely.
Out.
Absolutely.
So,
I mean, frankly, in real life, Dr. Shirley, Mahershala's character, I doubt he even liked Viggo Mortensen's character a little bit. Because how could you?
I doubt he was a doctor.
I doubt he's ever even been to the South.
Yeah. Are we sure he plays piano? Look, it's are we sure about that?
I know we've talked a lot about Green Book. It's this weird guilty pleasure of mine because there's absolutely all kinds of reasons why this would be a problematic movie. But and I don't know if
it is a problematic movie. That's okay. I'm going to stay quiet about it.
It's yeah. I mean, like it's there's something about it. There's what is it? It's not like I don't want to say the word contagious. But there's something lovable about kind of what it's trying to do, even if it's some of its efforts are misguided from like a cultural standpoint. Like if you throw all that out and just take it at face value and not take it as a grander like commentary or lesson on, you know, like I'll put it this way. I the other day when I was watching, I don't remember what movie, I think it was Vice actually. I was heading to the theater as Green Book was getting out and this older, very old, sorry, white gentleman was walking out with another senior aged couple, and he makes this remark that literally just stopped me in my tracks and I had to turn my head. But he's talking to them being like, yeah, see, that's, you know, that's the thing. That was the thing about racism back then, is that it existed and there was a lot of it, but thankfully that's all gone today.
Oh, no.
And I was like, is that the message you got from that movie? Is that there was racism back then, but not today? Because that's one, it's not the message intended. And it's also certainly not reality or truth. But he's walking away just almost like patting himself on the back. Like, we did it, whites. We solved racism. Like, no.
Well, here's the thing. I defer to Mahershala Ali, and he's proud of that movie. So if he's proud of it, I'm proud of it.
He's so good in it.
He's awesome.
I enjoyed the heck out of that movie. I'm honestly not ashamed. I should, like, part of me, there's this little voice that's like, don't tell people you liked it. But no, I liked it. It's good. You know, it was an enjoyable time at the movie.
Can I get my two cents on it? I'll be quick about it.
Wait, hold on. Wait a minute.
We'll give you one cent.
If you're going to disagree with us, then no.
No, I did have a lot of fun with it. I think it's undeniably like a crowd pleaser. Mm-hmm. My thing. Did either of you see The Hate U Give?
No.
Mm-mm. So I was comparing Green Book and The Hate U Give with a friend of mine. And I think my thing is that a movie like Green Book is trying to make you feel like, oh yeah, we've come so far. Like we've gotten over racism. Like, and it's meant to make you feel really good about yourself. Whereas The Hate U Give, I went out of that sobbing thinking, wow, there's so much more I should be doing. And I didn't necessarily feel good about myself or humanity, but I thought that it was more true to like all the work we still need to do. And so I think that's the difference.
Do you think that was the intention of the filmmakers that, I mean, because you could distill it down to this is just a relationship movie between two people in the subculture of a, you know, racist,
yes,
South. But like, do you think that was the intended effect going out? It may have been, but is that how you interpreted the message of the movie?
I mean, I don't think they necessarily intended that way, but underneath it, I think it's trying to make you feel good, about yourself, or like, why can't we all just get along? Like, this isn't as hard as you're making it out to be. And I'm like, ooh, no, it's like way more complicated.
Well, let's talk about Black Klansmen. I mean, they have literally the same moral to the story. So is Black Klansmen wrong?
Ooh. So wait, what would you say is the moral of the story of Black Klansmen?
That if we can reach out to the other side and we can look past our race, we can join together and transcend these racist bigots.
Okay, wow.
That's Black Klansman.
Do you think?
Was that the moral? I don't think that was the
moral. I was like, look, I don't know. Unless the other side's Topher Grace, I mean.
Yeah.
See, but Black Klansman was another one at the end where, especially with the footage of Trump, and it was another one that made me think, wow, like, yes, that situation of the movie kind of got wrapped up a little bit more neatly, but then he ends it with all that footage to say, no, we still have all of these problems now, so don't think we're done. Don't think this ended all nicely, because there's still problems.
Also, don't look up the true story behind Black Klansman either.
Another one. Yes, another one.
don't do it. You're just going to be disappointed.
Don't do it. This may or may not have been like a single phone call. That may or may not have happened. No, I mean, like, it's...
Oh, no.
Like, I'm 100% fine from taking the essence of something and blowing it up for cinema. Like, I don't need my movies to...
Oh, I don't care if that was real or not.
So, like, similar with Black Klansman. Like, that's so different from what the story that it's based on. But that's fine. It's a, you know, it's not... It's not meant to be a complete exact retelling or you know, reenactment, but yeah. That's a movie that I was just happy to see Spike Lee flex that creative muscle. I haven't seen him flex in a long time. I mean, that was something. Wasn't a perfect movie. I don't think I loved the clips at the end quite as much as everyone else, just because I feel like that really dates movies. But in the effort,
well,
now,
is it that or is it something fair. Else?
Well, it's also, I mean, I just think you got to respect The Office.
Well, it's because there was good people on both sides and they only showed
one
side.
That's the thing, yeah. Because all those people, on, you know, the David Duke side, I mean, they can't be all bad, right? I mean, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding, everyone. They're all, every one of those people are bad.
There's something about the name David that really.
Yeah. Is Black Klansman going to be talked about more on this pod? Is it on your list?
Not for me. Mm-mm. Okay.
Not for my end either.
I think it was 16 for me, so I'm not going to be talking about it either. So
it is a good
I'm
one,
glad
though.
I'm glad that organically
we got it in there.
Its way into the convo. So, so anyway, that was your number 8 was Green Book, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, sorry, no, we diverted just so much.
My number 8, let's see here. I got an image for it. I'm going to pull up. It was Bo Burnham's 8th Grade. So hey. I'm going to say just a little bit about it. Mostly because we've already done a whole pod on it, Shannon and I, and I'm going to take a wild guess that Shannon might have more to say about this later.
I might have more to say about it.
Hey, I do too.
I will say this. I don't find Bo Burnham to be a particularly talented stand-up comedian. I should say this. It's just not my cup of tea. His humor doesn't really resonate with me. However, this is proof that regardless of the career that got him famous, that his talent as a storyteller is supreme. I mean, this movie, considering from the perspective of an 8th grade girl, something that Bo Burnham is an experience he didn't have, but obviously could relate to or understand enough to make a movie that felt genuinely authentic and cringeworthy and as uncomfortable as middle school was for everybody. But do that with heart, with characters you cared about, with a parent character you cared about, with enough drama, like real drama, things that I don't feel like were totally outrageous or manufactured. Like the drama was real from the pool scene, which was just an audacious scene that I have a hard time even thinking about just because I curled up into a ball in my little reclined seat in the theater during the pool party scene just because I felt for this poor girl. And I felt similarly in situations where I just was, you know, I felt like I was uncomfortable in my own skin or that I didn't belong in a certain place. And yeah. I just think this film was really incredibly done, especially for a first time filmmaker that I don't think is a good stand up comedian. I can't say that enough times about how unfunny he is. But I honestly can't wait to watch whatever Bo Burnham directs next because I'm in. He just did an excellent job with this movie. So that's my number 8. 8 is 8th grade, which is why I put it there.
Perfect.
So, Shannon, number 7.
Yeah. So my number 7 is Blindspotting. This was my favorite film from Sundance. And I recently rewatched it to make sure that I still really liked it, and I still really, really like it. And upon a second watch, too, I got so much more out of it, too. So. It's really excellent. The star of it is David Diggs of Hamilton fame, and I'm not going to lie, that is the reason absolutely that I went to see it. It's written by him and his like real life best friend, Rafael Casal. And I guess the main plot of it, so David plays, can't remember his name, Colin, he's just gotten out of jail. He's a convicted felon and he's on probation. And he is supposed to be on probation for a year. And the movie starts when he's got only a few days left. And he, like 3 days before he's off, is driving home and he witnesses a police officer shoot an unarmed black man. And so that obviously really affects him. And what else? His best friend Miles and his just kind of not good for him at all. And so I don't know, the movie is on one hand, you know, it's kind of about the Black Lives Matter movement. On the other hand, they live in Oakland, and so it's about the gentrification of Oakland. There are so many layers to it that I don't know. And it ends on a really great scene. So obviously I know David from being like a very talented rapper. And I'm just going to spoil that because it's the best part. But he actually, so he works for a moving company, finds out that the police officer is, he goes in to move this house and it's the police officer's home. So he confronts him. He's now off probation. And so he takes a gun and is pointing it at this police officer. And he does this rap that is so, it just, it's so incredible and left me in tears. And so that scene's on YouTube. If you don't watch the film, I would at least go and watch that because that was so impactful. But it also has moments of being really funny, like I've talked about. It's very deep and, you know, it's a lot at times, but it also has really light moments mixed in there too. So yep. Really recommend Blindspotting.
This one I did not catch. That's so I'm glad you're recommending it. For a second there, when you said that you were going to spoil the end, I thought you were just going to say, he dies.
oh, no.
Oh, wait, he doesn't die. So you just spoiled the ending.
He doesn't die, sorry.
Oh, yeah. That was inadvertent. I guess I spoiled it anyway. All right. Aaron, your number seven.
My number seven is a tiny little A24 movie called A Prayer Before Dawn.
Whoa.
This is a big year for A24, and this is one of the movies that was one of the more powerful ones. I don't know if you guys know anything about this movie.
I didn't know you even seen it.
I know.
Okay, so this is a movie that is not for everyone. It's a true life story.
The anti-Green of a, Book.
Exactly. It's the antithesis to Green Book. No, this is the true life story of a man by the name of Billy Moore. He's an English boxer who went to live in Thailand. And he trained Muay Thai, and he got addicted to drugs, and he started dealing drugs, and he ended up in their most dangerous prison, literally the most dangerous prison in Thailand. This is a white British man who doesn't speak Thai, doesn't speak the language, who finds himself amongst gangs and drugs and just violent, thuggish criminals. And it's all about how he survived that experience. And how he found love in prison, actually. It was a really interesting story. Very, very graphic. Extremely graphic. Another dark story. But it's also the story of one man's journey back into the light. So I found this one really interesting. Again, not a movie for everyone. But awesome. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's called A Prayer Before Dawn. And I think it's on Amazon right now. Prime. So
Amazon Prime,
you can find it streaming. Yep,
but check that out.
All right, my number seven is another film that I'll try to be brief about because it's another one I'm assuming we'll talk more in detail with, or maybe Aaron will. But that film is Sorry to Bother You. This is Boots Riley's film, his directorial debut. A film with Lakeith Stanfield and Tessa Thompson. And to be honest with you, I did not go to this film because I'm a big Boots Riley stan. I went because of Tessa and Lakeith, who currently have a perfect batting average in their film. I mean, they literally have perfect. I look at their film. It's like everything they've done, I've enjoyed both of them. I mean, they're both these stars that are on this parallel or similarly meteoric rise together. And it's exciting to watch. I mean, Tessa's probably has surpassed Lakeith in terms of like name recognition, obviously, at the Marvel movies and Creed and other ones. But both are just a really exciting point in their careers. And this movie is, I'm just grateful that they didn't get too big to have done a movie like this, because this is a movie that commits to the premise. This is a movie that makes no bones about its message. It's not subtle. It's very political. To be clear, I do not agree with all of the political ideas that are espoused in this film. But that doesn't mean I can't enjoy it. And I think that's important. It's not Fahrenheit 11/9, which is which is a perfect film. No, I'm kidding. This is a movie that has a lot to say, from the importance of organizing, the importance of workers, the power of truth to power, the idea of fighting for, I guess just to put it surface level, fighting for a living wage. And the power of getting together and protesting and you know, fighting for your basic human rights and decency. In addition to that, there's a commentary on capitalism that's going on that, you know, if you go in with political opinions and you want, you know, your movies to match them, this movie's going to be just not for you, probably no matter where you come from politically. But I appreciate how committed the movie is because it just goes for it. And that especially happens in the third act when it does this thing that is so wild and so bananas. But I'm so appreciative of it because it takes the theme to an extreme of what could happen if we allowed this. And some might argue that it's really all not that extreme, that it's like actually within the realm of possibility of what people would be willing to do to maximize profits and other things. And I'll just I'll stop speaking.
You forgot to mention the gentrification of Oakland.
Well, that's going to say, how many movies are going to talk about the gentrification of Oakland? Black Panther, also gentrification of Oakland. The opening scene in Oakland.
Lots of Oakland.
That's three movies right there, which is incredible.
I didn't have this one on my list, but I loved it. I did love this movie.
Oh, you don't have it. I thought you would. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I was a big fan of the movie. So.
Well.
Can I do a brag for a minute?
Well, you did refer to this as only 2/3 of a good movie recently. I'm assuming you mean 2/3 of a good movie and 1/3 of a great movie. But.
I loved it up until that third act, and then I was like, whoa, this is too much for me. It's a lot. But so this is another Sundance one. I went to the world's, like, their premiere of it. And if you can imagine, so I stayed after for the Q&A. Every actor from that film was there within like 10 feet away from me. So you got Armie Hammer and Lakeith and Tessa, everyone.
Tell me you went up to
that
Armie
Hammer.
That
is a killer cast right there.
Did you interact with Armie at all or no?
No, I actually, so my shift was right after in that theater. So I had to sneak out. So I probably looked like I was just hightailing it out of there, or else I would have stayed and tried to talk to them all. But
because I'm imagining
I got pictures.
Like, isn't there? Yeah, they're supposed to. You said there's two of you. Is there? Where's the other?
How's your brother doing?
I bet you anything he would just love that bit to pieces. Because
one of my favorite movies ever.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Social Network. That's crazy. A different Army movie is one of my favorites ever. It's The Lone Ranger. I'm kidding.
No.
That's Johnny Depp at his most problematic.
Isn't that wasn't even the thing that brought him down.
Johnny Depp and Red Face. Come on, man. Johnny.
The worst.
Not cool.
Anyway. Yet he still got the Grindelwald part because, you know, why not? Get the guy who played Tonto.
We can't talk about
this. It's Hollywood, man. What are you going to do?
Unbelievable.
Too
JK
bitter.
JK could have stopped it. JK, you have blood on your hands. All right.
Man.
Okay. Back to Sorry to Bother You. Worth noting, I love this cast. There's a lot of great parts. Steven Yeun from Walking Dead and Burning on your list has a nice little role in there. You've got Terry Crews.
That's right.
Which is great. I'm all in on this movie. Even the third act, which is admittedly it's a tougher pill to swallow. But it's in line with the vision Boots had, and I think that it was zany enough of a universe that like I get it. But I love the commitment to the bit. It's it's my number 7 film. I love it.
And there are so few things where I can truly say I've never seen anything like that before. This year, it was that and probably Into the Spider-Verse were the two movies I thought, wow, I've never seen anything like that before. Sure. So that's to its credit, definitely.
So are we at our number 6 now?
Yeah.
Let's do this. Tell me what you think. We'll do our number 6, and then we'll take a quick break and then come back to do our top 5.
Sure.
That'll work for you guys because we're at a little over an hour. So, Shannon, hit us
Sounds
with your
great.
6.
So my 6 is 8th grade, which we've talked about. So I can do this quickly. I agree with everything that you said about it. I really loved it. I thought it's crazy that Bo Burnham, who I honestly, is it Make Happy? His comedy special on Netflix. I really do like that one, so I don't have like the bias against him to begin with, but it's crazy that someone who that he could write this movie from a perspective of a teenage girl who is not from the same generation as him. He didn't have that experience, but by all accounts, like, it's so true to, it made me really worried about everyone who's younger than me and has to deal with Snapchat and, like, other crap that's, I don't know. I'm like, wow, even, I mean, it felt true to, like, my middle school experience, but also, wow, now kids have it even worse now and a lot of other issues to deal with, especially with the rise of technology. Just one other thing I wanted to mention is that the soundtrack of this I thought was so creative and interesting. I listened to an interview with Bo Burnham where he was asked, like, why didn't you just do the soundtrack because you have a background and, like, in his comedy specials, he does songs and whatnot. But he wanted to find someone who could really, it's Anna Meredith who does the soundtrack, and he wanted to find someone who could really, I don't know, it sounds like the technology, you know, it's hard to explain. It's kind of like synthy and, but it sounds really like upbeat and then really dramatic when it needs to. I just thought it added so much to the film, especially that pool party where it's kind of doing this like ba-bomb sort of thing. But yeah, music and it's
no, that's
great.
You know, I didn't even think about the soundtrack. It is really great. That's a great point.
Yeah. And not in the running for the Oscars, which I'm bitter about. So... But anyway,
I heard Mary Poppins, by the way, got 2 songs in for consideration, and Star Is Born got 1, which was just kind of shocking to me.
Especially because the music in Mary Poppins Returns was kind of the one bummer about it. I really enjoyed it, except the music is just not that memorable.
I actually enjoyed Mary Poppins Returns. I mean, it's not better music.
Yeah, I really liked it, but the yeah, I think the music's kind of forgettable though.
Well,
anyway,
yeah, I mean, I was going to prove you wrong by reciting my favorite number from it, but I actually can't remember it. So
there you go. Exactly.
It was good. Everything but Lin-Manuel going into Hamilton mode with his rapping. I was like, oh, Lin.
Does he do? Oh, of course he does.
So
I do too. I do too. But
he could do no wrong.
He didn't write any of the music for that movie, which is crazy. You would cast Lin-Manuel and not let him do what he does best, because, like, as much as I like him, performing is not his, like, in a movie is not his strongest suit. And so not like if you could perform and have written the songs he does, like, that's fine. But, like, considering you have him just for the acting, like, okay, I don't know what's going on here.
Yeah.
But all right. So Aaron,
right? Number what are we?
6.
Number 6? Okay, number 6 I have.
Yes.
Fahrenheit 11/9.
There it is.
There's the movie. So you talked about having this being like a political movie year with certain movies talking about race and whatnot. Fahrenheit 11/9 is not subtle at all. And, you know, I appreciate it for what it is.
Except the Flint stuff. I think the Flint stuff applies to everyone across the board.
Of course, absolutely. And I talked to you, I think, did we talk about this movie?
Yeah,
where I thought my feeling is that this was originally some sort of either TV show that Michael Moore pitched or something bigger than just a movie, because he fits so many topics into this 2.5-hour documentary that it feels disjointed at times. But I think he has important things to say. And for me personally, his documentaries have really contributed to my politicization. Like, when I was growing up and when I became a young adult and I took an interest in politics, I immediately found myself enjoying his documentaries, and I felt like they informed a lot of my curiosity and the things that I started to gravitate towards. And this Fahrenheit 11/9, it's extremely heavy-handed, but I enjoyed it. I think that he brings up, again, some really interesting points. And, you know, he's not perfect. He's not a perfect documentarian. He has a gigantic ego, and he makes it about himself a lot of the times. And he has an unhealthy fixation with our president, which a lot of people do. So I feel like that's the weakest point. Like, that stuff about Trump is, like, the weakest part of the movie, and I could have done without it, but he doesn't get the movie made without that stuff, so I get it.
Like, to that point, I agree with your theory that he wanted to make a Flint water crisis movie and he couldn't get it greenlit, so he said it was going to be an anti-Trump movie, and he got it greenlit immediately, and then just filled it. You know, it's got, it's like a, you know, the bun of a, you know, of a hamburger is just the Trump parts, but all the stuff inside, all the meat, all the, every, all the ingredients is really, it's Flint, right?
The reason to stick around is, yeah. Like he has an understanding of Michigan, obviously, especially Flint. He's from Flint. He's made movie. He made a movie about Flint, his first documentary that was really big. And so this was like his homecoming. And I mean, he understands the people that live there, even though he doesn't live there full time anymore.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's still a crisis, and it needs a light to be shined on it. And I'm glad that he made this. And well, it, know, was, it was really entertaining.
The movie
at the end of the day,
tomorrow, when it had its DVD release and they rebranded it to Live, Die, Repeat.
Yeah.
Watch them rebrand Fahrenheit 11/9. Terrible branding just to begin with.
But they
just completely rebrand it to like a Flint title document. He just actually names it what it was meant to be all along. I'll be all in on that.
Yeah, I would support a recut where he just talks about Flint. Although a lot of the stuff that some of the other topics he tackles is like the teachers unions, which are really important. Yeah. That stuff's really interesting. A lot of the regular day people mobilizing and becoming political and actually running campaigns. Some of the people that he featured actually won their campaigns, and now they're elected representatives. So it's pretty interesting, and I think that he did a really good job. And it was one of the more entertaining movies I saw this year. So that's how it made it my list.
The dude, he knows how to entertain, like cut an entertaining doc. Like he knows how to make it. You know.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason he has the most profitable documentary of all time.
That's right.
He knows what he's doing, so.
All right. My number six, the last movie we'll chat about before we take a quick few-minute break, and we'll be right back with our top five. My six is a movie that Shannon talked about earlier, Minding the Gap, the Hulu documentary that is not actually about skateboard culture, though that's the wrappings that you think you're... You know, as you're approaching this movie, you think it's going to be this skateboarding culture movie. And quite frankly, the director, Bing Liu, I think he also thought that's what he was making. And I think that's part of the magic of this movie is Bing Liu discovering what the movie was that he was making. And I think in the documentary form, oftentimes you approach a topic or a story that's been told or has happened or is ongoing, and you come in wanting to tell that story as it's, or whatever has been established of it, right? And you come in and you come up with, you know, you interview people, you ask questions, you start to form the story together. That's not the case with Bing Liu. He was just filming stuff as kids do in high school. I did this all the time. Not to say I only like movies that I can personally relate to, although that seems like my list, that's often the case. But, you know, I obviously made a lot of skate movies I've talked about in my mid-90s review. I love doing that with my friends. But the idea of just filming things that you find interesting without a story in mind necessarily, but then discovering that story as you're doing it and then starting to make that movie about that is like that's when special documentaries are made. This is one of those, because the skateboarding culture stuff is important. And as I mentioned earlier, Bing Liu absolutely did everything that Jonah Hill wished he could have done. This has got to be crushing to Jonah Hill. I can't imagine him watching this because
terrible timing.
He's going to look at this movie and be like, this is so freaking good. And it's everything I wish that my movie could be. Now, of course, Minding the Gap delves into topics and, you know, more detail or other things that mid-90s isn't necessarily about. But the general, like, really the general theme of mid-90s is there in Minding the Gap. And that's about not just the skateboarding, but the home lives. What pushes these people to skateboarding and what that means to them as a reprieve from their otherwise difficult lives. But Bing Liu really goes in on, as you referenced, Shannon, the domestic violence angle. And that as he realizes the commonality between him and his two friends that he's documenting, and he becomes a subject of the documentary upon that realization. And there are some striking and candid interviews with his friends and relatives and other people of those friends. And this was an astonishing documentary. I was watching it just with my jaw was dropped at just everything that was going on. I just think he made something special. I hope he can have a successful career as a filmmaker, but this is one of those things that's like getting lightning in a bottle. It's that good, but he's clearly a talented filmmaker, so I hope he's able to make a lot of movies and more documentaries. Please, we need more great documentaries like this. But man, this is...
this was something special. I loved this movie. It's for the how dark the subject matter is, domestic violence. I mean, you don't want to tell people to go watch this documentary about domestic violence. Like, no one wants to watch that. But it also weirdly seemed hopeful and optimistic by the end in a way that's totally hard, or not totally easy to articulate. But it's absolutely worth the hour and a half. And yeah. It's on Hulu, Minding the Gap.
Yep. That part, that interview with his mom, too, I keep thinking about how she, he's asking her how, I don't know, like how soon she knew about the violence and all this. And she just turns it right back on him. And you see, like, in real time, him realizing what the doc is actually about and him trying to work through it. It's really incredible.
Oh, the interview with his mom was so, I wanted him to end the interview. Like, stop, I can't handle anymore, just because the emotion was so, I don't want to say uncomfortable, but, yeah, it was really, really good. I don't want to say anymore, so go see Minding the Gap. So that is our first half of the pod. We're going to take a quick break. Those of you on Facebook Live, we'll just take a quick break. We'll be right back for our top five films of 2018. Those of you listening to the pod, just click on the next episode. But yep, we'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to the Brave Little Podcast. Hold on to your butts.